This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Lovely day in the neighborhood. Interesting election returns. We're going to be talking about variations on that theme all day. Just to let you know, and we're going to go right to Colonel Vindman in 2 seconds, because our lawless president-in-chief needs to be removed. And since we can't find enough Republican senators to remove him, we must remove him. And we are going to be playing Colonel Vindman's powerful testimony every single day between now and the election. But before we do anything, once again, this is our day three. Colonel Vindman, every single day between now and the election, we need to remember Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, affectionately known as the Voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And I just need to remind my audience that we taped this on Thursday morning, so God forbid something should happen Thursday night. We will not be reflecting it in our conversation. What we can do, however, is reflect what happened on Wednesday night, which was the last debate before the Nevada caucus. The Nevada caucus will be happening on Saturday. But this is kind of an interesting caucus. It's kind of a bifurcated sort of situation where they have a little bit that feels kind of primary-ish in the sense that there's early voting and then it's caucus-ish. So they could fail twice. You know, they could fail with the primary stuff and the caucus stuff. Only I'm hoping that we get some really interesting numbers coming out of Nevada, whatever it is. Anyway, Nevada.
And I'm a stickler for that, by the way. Almost no one on my television says Nevada correctly. And, of course, everyone's talking about Nevada nonstop.
Okay. Well, you will pronounce it.
I'm a frequent visitor to Nevada, so I've gotten their lecture about
Nevada.
You got to listen to the way that the man who built the Nevada Democratic Party, Harry Reid, how does he say it?
Okay. Well, the thing that's really important for me is that whenever I go to a place, I suddenly realize I begin to have like an Asian accent when I go to visit Shanghai. I start having a New York accent. Have to go there. That's all. You know, just send me and I'll be fine.
Bring it down here to Texas. We'll give you a Texas accent.
I'm ready. Let's talk a little bit about the debate on Wednesday night. It was feisty. It didn't really get off much of the healthcare issue and attacking Bloomberg issue and whatever. So from a purpose of content, it wasn't. But it really was an opportunity to see people sort of rising to a new level, or in this case, Bloomberg. Anyway, what do you want to say about Bloomberg?
I'm trying to be polite. It's interesting that all of these candidates were piling on Bloomberg. I thought that Elizabeth Warren had a particularly strong performance. And by the way, she really needed it, right, based on where she's at in the contest so far after Iowa and New Hampshire. But if you were advising candidates on what they needed to do to win the primary, I would think you would tell them to go after the front runner, Bernie Sanders, not after the guy just because he's new on stage. Not that Bloomberg shouldn't have to answer questions. I'm not saying that. But strategically, wouldn't you go after the guy who's racking up delegates and moving forward and is winning these states and is expanding his base, according to some of the polling, including the one from NPR just the other day? Bernie Sanders is sort of running away with it while the quote-unquote moderates are, you know, sniping at each other.
Well,
I thought that, you know, Joe Biden had, you know, his best debate so far, although the bar has been low for Joe so far in these exchanges. I would say that for Mayor Bloomberg, it's interesting, Arnie. He could do what a lot of the wealthy candidates that I've watched over the years in Texas and in other places, a lot of what they would do is just skip these things. I mean, he's moving the numbers by not being in debate so far, right? He's been moving his poll numbers up by having very controlled events, avoiding the press in large part, not answering tough questions, doing all this advertising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in television advertising so far. That's been making his poll numbers go up, particularly in Super Tuesday states, which are coming up, including California and Texas in particular. And I saw some of the other smaller states that are coming up on Super Tuesday. I think, what is it, 14 or 15 states that vote, including some places, smaller places like Oklahoma, et cetera, are running up the numbers. Here in Texas, I will mention this, a Republican operative from West Texas who does a lot of business in Lubbock and Abilene out west of 35 was saying that he was seeing a lot of television advertising from Bloomberg in these smaller places, like Taylor County, for example, just a small West Texas county. And you're thinking, why is he doing that? For anyone else, that'd be a waste of money, but it's not for him, because under the rules, the way these delegates are going to be apportioned for these candidates, if you're getting 15% statewide in Texas, you get delegates. But it's also that you look at the state Senate districts, which are massive out in West Texas. One state Senate district, the one that includes Amarillo, is just about the same size as Indiana.
Wow.
So, but geographically. So, if you can pick up 1,000 people out there who are, I mean, there are still Democrats out there, Arnie. Most people are Republicans who live out there, but there are Democrats. If you can get 100 of them, 300, 400, you know, if you perform like 10% statewide in Texas, but you get 20% in some of these state Senate districts, you'll get delegates. So he's blanketing the whole area, and I'm sure he's doing that in every other state, too, because he's spending, you know, north of $300 million on television advertising. So interesting that he even felt the need to go up there. A lot of times when one of these wealthy people would run, you'd have other candidates saying, why won't he debate us? Why won't he get on stage with us? Well, he took his lumps last night. I don't know that he answered all the questions to the satisfaction of a lot of people, especially on stop and frisk and about on the questions about, a hostile workplace at his business. But he did get out there and, mix it up with the rest. I'll give him credit for that.
I think what you saw with his performance last night is that if the success strategy for 2020 is expanding the base, who's going to be motivated to go out for Bloomberg? I mean, name a young person under the age of 35. Name me a Hispanic or a Black who's going to be – I mean, I just hate to say that, but watching his arrogance, watching his inability to engage, watching his inability to answer questions, I mean, it was – at least – I mean, Donald Trump is a performance artist. Let's understand this.
What you was Bernie.
He just
has a smaller base.
No. It's absolutely true. They're both performance
artists. That's
the
problem. That's the problem, though. One is boring but might be able to appeal to more people who won't be fired up. The other is very fired up and has a base that is fired up but is a smaller group of people. So if you look at what's happening in the Democratic Party, Arnie, let's get real. I mean, you have Bernie who probably, according to these polls, may be expanding his base a little bit. But just anecdotally, go to his events. You've talked to the people who are Bernie supporters, and I think did the media and the rest sort of eventually force you into Bernie's arms there in the New Hampshire primary? I think maybe that's the way it was said. I sit here and I think to myself, yes, the guy has folks who are fired up, but there's a ceiling on his support. And look at the fact that of the quote-unquote moderates, according to the elections so far, they make up the majority of the Democratic Party. They're just split up among all these candidates. There's still too many candidates on stage, is my point. To really have a choice between these.
Well, I am going to be worried about this because I understand that the moderates may have a greater sort of percentage right now, but the
moderates in America.
Know what? Here's the problem: those moderates don't always show up. Those moderates
they're not the Tea Party, and not the Bernie people.
Exactly.
The ones who would crawl through the glass and crawl through broken glass in the rain. That's the Bernie people.
That is the Bernie people. And you know what we found out? We need both. We need both.
Sure.
And now the question is, did you see one candidate up there that could thread together the... And so I just posted something on Facebook.
No, I don't.
No, I know. Let me just say something.
That's scary.
So this morning I just posted something on Facebook because I am wild. And this is where I'm wild and angry at Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders compromised when he was the mayor of Burlington. Bernie Sanders compromised when he was a congressman. Bernie Sanders compromised when he was a United States senator. And we even know he might compromise if he's president. Why? Because AOC let it drop. What AOC said, well, is if we can't get the Medicare for all, maybe we could get some sort of an aggressive public option. Well, you know what? That's exactly true. And what Bernie hasn't said is, and this is the difference between Bernie and Amy. Amy basically is a little bit like Barack Obama. He pre-compromised. Before Barack Obama even offered anything, he gave the Republicans everything he thought they wanted, and they still rejected it. You know that. He didn't get one Republican vote for the Heritage Foundation health care plan. Can I remind everyone? The Affordable Care Act.
That was their deal.
Right. That was their deal, and it suddenly became the communist deal. So one of the things you learn in politics, and you know because you've been covering it for years, and I've been doing it for years, if you don't dream bigger, you don't even get to the middle. And what Bernie is doing is saying, ultimately, the goal is to find a healthcare system that's cheaper, that's available to everyone, and that, frankly, people don't want to have to connect it to their job because their job is about their wages and not about their health. And
affordability, that's really, take it with them. No, I get it. And I guess another way to say what you're saying is, you have to go in with a strong bargaining position.
Exactly. Thank you.
Trump knows how to do this. I mean, Trump goes in and will have the most extreme position in any negotiation.
Yep.
And then if he gets anything, he claims it a victory.
Exactly. So I just want and Bernie has never said that. Elizabeth tries to say it, but she doesn't do it effectively. Let me just be honest with you. I mean, the one thing you did see when she sort of attacked Bloomberg last night, and I'm going to probably say this 24 times during the course of this week, is that she, in a way, Bloomberg was a stand-in for Wall Street. Bloomberg was a standard for crony capitalism. Bloomberg was a standard for – and what you saw
at the
end –
liberals love Bloomberg on that stage. Bloomberg being there lets them say everything they want to say.
Well, the NDAs –
I mean, this was a fantasy for Bernie and for Warren to be able to go after a billionaire on stage. By the way, isn't there something sort of satisfying about having having to have the guy – raise his hand to be recognized.
I know.
He has to do that in his business.
I know. He's never had to do that. I think he was just sort of shocked. The one thing that's really shocking, though, is not only does he have billions of dollars to spend on this campaign, but I have been prepped for debates when I was running for governor. I was prepped for debates when I was running for Congress. They were brutal. They anticipated every single thing that would be coming in at me. They spent hours working with me, so I was not only prepared, but I was forewarned. Tell me about Bloomberg. With all those gazillions of dollars, with all those experts, with all those people from Bloomberg News that are now on his payroll, how the hell was he so unprepared? Or maybe he doesn't care. Maybe there's a level of arrogance that I'm buying this election. You just have to stick with whatever I say. Well, you know what? That doesn't make a good president, but it does make a good despot.
So far, what we have been watching is great staff work by Bloomberg. When I attended the Mike for Black America rally in Houston last week,
after he
spoke on the radio.
Mike for Black America.
You talk about. I mean, you laugh.
Oh
this
my
was
God!
This was one of the most well stagecrafted things I have ever seen. Yolanda Adams, who's a big gospel singer, Grammy Award winner from Houston, gets on stage and does, America the Beautiful. They have an NFL star talk. They have the African-American mother whose son was killed in gun violence holding up his football cleats. People just about crying. The African-American mayor of the fourth largest city in the United States, Sylvester Turner, gets up and speaks his sort of preaching sort of way of speaking, gets the crowd into it. And it's almost like they had a prayer circle around Mike Bloomberg, after the comments had come out about stop and frisk, about, throwing the young men against the wall in New York City. And so it's staff work that we've seen so far. I don't know if Bloomberg doesn't care. I'm not sure that's correct. But, he's never been the most charismatic public.
No, he does care.
When I sat through his speech in Houston, right before that Mike for Black America rally, he spoke at the Harris County Democratic Party's big fundraiser dinner that they do every year, which, Arnie, I'm old enough to remember when they had to beg people to come speak to the Harris County Democrats in Houston about 10 years ago. Now it's the center of the political universe.
Right.
Julian Castro was there speaking after Bloomberg, and earlier in the day, Castro had been sort of tweeting hatred at Bloomberg because of the stop and frisk comments. So they had to sort of orchestrate that and put Bloomberg, first on the program and put Castro sort of toward the end. I don't know if they even wanted them in the same room at the same time. But, there were hecklers in the crowd, and one guy jumps up, and it's probably a room of about 2,000 people, Arnie. You have a guy jump up and say, Bloomberg's really a Republican. He's really a Republican. And, you know, security takes him out. And then some other protester sort of rushes the stage. Security has to grab her as she's, I think, yelling something about stop and frisk. But good staff work so far. Last night or two nights ago, as we, as this will air on Friday, you got to see Bloomberg, unvarnished. You got to see him on
stage.
And when you get to see the actual person, that's a different image.
Well, and let me just say something. Bloomberg does care. But what we really see with Bloomberg is that because of his billions, and Jeff Bezos is the same way. I guess he just donated $10 billion to climate change. I just want to sort of figure out where that's going to go. But anyway, the problem with very, very wealthy people who do care is they get to pick what they care about. So if you're one of the 150 cities that benefited from the largesse of Mayor Bloomberg, hallelujah. But if you're Berlin, New Hampshire, you didn't see a frickin' dime. If you are, upstate New York outside of Albany, you didn't see a frickin' dime. So the problem with billionaires is they get to choose based on their ideology, on the emotion of the moment, where they're going to direct their cash. Ultimately, what we need in America is a public policy that lifts all cities, that repairs all infrastructure, that cleans all water, and we don't have to depend on where Bloomberg wants to write a check to write it off, by the way, his taxes. So as you hear Bezos giving $10 billion for climate change, please understand, ladies and gentlemen, $3 billion of it will be paid for by the U.S. taxpayer because he gets to write that off his tax liability. Understand that we are helping him pay for his choice, not our need.
Every time I've seen someone who is very wealthy in this state, and of course the presidency, running for that is a different stage.
Right.
But every time, especially in recent election cycles, Arnie, when they have been successful, it's when they were doing what Bloomberg was doing before the debate this week, which is going with the very controlled sort of campaign, where, again, not really talking to reporters, not doing press conferences, having these very controlled events, running lots of television and radio advertisements as well. And when, for example, in the Houston area, there was a Congress candidate. She ended up losing and not even making a runoff after spending $6 million in 2018. That's the congressional seat that's now held by Dan
Crenshaw.
Can
I lose for $2 million? Could I lose for $2 million, please?
Yeah, right. There was a Texas Senate candidate in DFW who lost after spending about $6 million as well in a Republican primary. And these candidates who are very wealthy, when they enter the arena with the normal folks, so to speak, it doesn't always go the way that they think that it would.
Right, exactly. So you mentioned in your in the email you sent me this morning that early voting is already underway in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And you said, so what are the early numbers tell us? So what are we hearing for other exit interviews? What are we getting? What are the numbers for turnout? And where are they? Are they located in cities or are they across the state? Is it kind of a buckshot?
So early voting is available to any eligible voter in Texas all across our 254 counties. So we have roughly 16 million people registered to vote.
Wow.
And people can, of course, vote in either the Democratic or Republican primary. They just can't vote in both. We don't register people by party in Texas.
Can't vote
in
both. Yep.
You walk in and you walk up to the Democratic table or the Republican table and you go for it. Here in Travis County, they now have, in Austin where I am, they have implemented the optical scanning machine. We went back to that, which is kind of an interesting way to do it because it's not the pencil and the bubbles like you have there.
Mm-hmm.
It's you hit a touch screen and then it prints it out for you so you can see the paper before you then feed it into the machine to do the tally.
Oh, that's not so bad. That's not so bad.
It's an interesting way to do it. And by the way, they had some concerns about the old touch screen machines that we had that did not give you any kind of a paper
printout
record. So in Travis County, they've moved in that direction. In the largest counties in Texas, including Harris County, where Houston is, Travis County, where I am, and Tarrant County, where Fort Worth is, Dallas County, Bexar County, where San Antonio is, turnout has been sort of light on the Democratic side right now, Arnie. There's really nothing to fire up Republicans in this primary. We don't have a lot of state-level races that are of importance on the Republican side really at all. The Speaker of the House, remember, was trying to negotiate a sort of a ceasefire with the right-wing groups in this state and not have a nasty Republican primary.
Right.
And, of course, there was a scandal out of that, and the Speaker is retiring. But It's sort of like a mutual suicide bombing because they were both successful. The speaker was taken out politically, and the speaker kind of got what he wanted. The right-wing groups are not running a lot of candidates, so there's really no reason, there's no big motivating factor for Republicans to be turning out. I don't have all the numbers in front of me right now, Arnie, because they're coming in from the big counties, and the small counties haven't all reported just yet what their first few days of early voting were, but the early voting does run through next week as well. And what we're seeing so far is it looks like Democrats are sort of trying to play strategist because the Republican and Democratic votes look to be kind of about even right now, which is interesting given what I just said, right, that there's really nothing to motivate Republicans.
Well,
on the Democratic side, you have the presidential contest. But think of it this way. If you're in Texas and you're a Texas Democrat who wants to have an impact on this race, you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, we have early voting here, but the Nevada caucuses are this weekend. The South Carolina primary is coming up the week after that. And then our election day on March 3rd happens in Texas. If you don't wait until election day in Texas and you go ahead and cast your ballot for, say, Mayor Pete or Amy or one of these others, they may have dropped out by the time.
Exactly.
In early voting, a lot of more sophisticated voters will say something like, well, you know, what if something comes out about one of these candidates, you know, between now and election day, and they want to sort of hedge their bet and just wait till election day. This is even worse than that. The person may not even be running by the time election day rolls around in Texas. So I would expect it to pick up a little bit after this weekend. I think some folks are going to look at how it goes in Nevada because, as has been said over and over again, that is a state that looks more like America with, you know, a large Latino population. There's more of an African-American population in South Carolina. But for those who would wait in Texas, if they would wait all the way until they see the results of South Carolina, they have no choice. Early voting will have been closed at that point, and they'll have to vote on Election Day. So we may see a huge turnout in Texas on Election Day. I am reminded that in 2008, when I was covering the presidential primary here, and it was Senator Clinton and Senator Obama facing off in that primary, there were about 3 million people, which at that point was a record, in Texas, the Democratic primary, 3 million people voting in that election. And, of course, our polls are open until 7 p.m., just like they are just about everywhere else. And when I was in Houston covering that election, there were people standing in line, Arnie, to vote for hours after 7 o'clock. Texas law says if you're standing in line at 7, you can vote. And so they were waiting in places like Fort Bend, north of Houston as well, up in Dallas, just waiting to cast that ballot, and we may see the same thing again.
So let me just say one quick thing as I'm listening to you, and that is that, so for example, the debate on Wednesday night was unfortunate because already about 75 to 80,000 people had already voted early. So even if someone had a breakout performance at that debate, it was too late. So one of the reasons why I think you're absolutely right about why you're seeing it some tepid in the voter turnout in Texas is people are really undecided, undecided.
Right.
And the beauty of the Republicans is there is no decision. It's Trump. And so, you know, if they show up, obviously where they're going. So I think with each passing primary and caucus, you realize almost the level of indecision is rising. It's not actually stabilizing. So I think in Texas, they're not just playing pundit. They really don't know what they want to do. And they want to see everyone sort of get exposed in both South Carolina and in Nevada, whatever the pronounce it
Nevada.
For me. Nevada.
So
thank you. Nevada. I don't want to screw it up.
Don't mess it up.
Yeah,
well, listen, I think what you're probably seeing, this is my educated guess, what you're probably seeing is those folks who are locked in for Bernie Sanders, who are not going anywhere else, they are probably already casting their ballots. Some of the more business-friendly Democrats who, and by the way, might even be some disaffected Republicans, just anecdotally, I've certainly heard from some of them, who have probably already voted for Bloomberg in Texas. But I think it's those other candidates who maybe, you know, still be able to make the case for the support of a lot of Texas Democrats who are, frankly, more moderate. Keep in mind, look, when Beto did well in Texas, when he almost beat Ted Cruz in 2018, that was before he became known as sort of a liberal firebrand.
Right.
He was a Texas Democrat. I mean, this is somebody who was not talking about gun confiscation like he would a year later. This is somebody who was not talking about punishing churches over their tax-exempt status like he would a year later. And so he's, by the way, he's going to play a factor in these elections as he runs around trying to help flip the Texas House of Representatives. But I think that those moderate Democrats here are trying to figure out which way they're going to go, and they're kind of in a no-win situation right now. Hard to make up their minds when they don't even know if the person that they might vote for is still going to be running for president in a couple weeks.
Yeah, the chaos of the primary. And you, of course, never provide us with chaos, but stability and information and facts. It is Scott Braddock. He's the editor of the Quorum Report. He's also known as the voice of Texas. If it's Friday, it must be Scott. Can't wait to talk next week. It's going to be so interesting.
Thanks so much, Arnie.
All right, bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. We're going to be talking about the Canadian healthcare system. Oh, that radical Medicare for all kind of version. Anyway, we'll be right back.
Bridging an urban-rural divide in the Midwest on this current cast. When excess fertilizer or manure washes off farm fields, it can contaminate water that supplies nearby cities. But farmers may hesitate to change their ways because it can affect the bottom line. Using less fertilizer can reduce crop yields, and other solutions, such as buffer strips, may require taking land out of production. So the cleanup often falls to cities.
So that sets up the potential for conflict right there.
Michael Taboris of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs says the issue is often approached as us versus them. So to facilitate cooperation, he suggests creating decision-making bodies made up of both urban and rural stakeholders.
To solve it as a collective problem.
Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Sex, 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 look at me! I'm in t- Hollow sea, poison beaches, limousines, toothless dentists, cops that kill. My baby's got the lonesome lows, don't quite go away overnight. Doctor blind, just prescribe the blue ones. If the dizzying highs don't subside,
welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. There was an article at Salon.com that really sort of resonated with me, in part because it really was almost the essence of the conversation and the debate on Wednesday night between what kind of healthcare system we should have. Igor, pronounce your last name.
Darish.
Igor Darish wrote an article at Salon.com entitled, "American Healthcare System Costs Four Times More Than Canada's Single-Payer System. The average American pays $2,497 a year for insurance overhead and administrative costs, while Canadians pay just $551. So what I realized as I was reading your article is that we pay for paper care and not for health care. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. And, you know, that's right. Even if you take away all the costs of the actual health care, you're left with a huge price tag just for the administrative costs for hospitals and insurance companies and the huge salaries they sometimes pay to their CEOs. So the study I wrote about, the researchers in the study who are affiliated with Hunter College here in New York, mm-hmm. the Harvard School of Medicine, University of Ottawa, they began actually looking at this more than two decades ago. So they found that the U.S. and Canada had roughly the same administrative cost before Canada adopted its single-payer system in 1962.
Right.
And since then, the two countries have hugely diverged. When the researchers first looked at this in 1999, they found that 30% of all healthcare expenses in the U.S. went towards administrative costs, which is about twice the rate that Canadians pay. So these administrative costs, like you said, they go towards insurance companies and hospital overhead and salaries. Executive pay has grown exponentially over the last few years. Some insurance companies now pay their CEO more than $20 million a year. And they're also getting huge profits. Last year, companies like Humana, Cigna, Anthem, they all reported quarterly profits more than $1 billion. So after covering the cost of all the health care and all the overhead and the salaries, these companies are pocketing billions of dollars a year while they're also charging huge premiums and deductibles. So after they looked at this in 99 and found that Americans paid about $1,000 per year in these administrative costs compared to $300 in Canada, they looked at it again in 2017 and found that the problem only got worse.
Yeah.
Right now, like you said, every man, woman, and child in America pays an average of almost $2,500 a year in administrative costs compared to about $550 in Canada. And that doesn't even factor in things like pharmaceuticals, where we see numerous middlemen taking large cuts that could result in unaffordable prices, and dentistry and other costs. And so this discrepancy you can see across the board. So Americans pay an average of $930 in hospital administrative costs, while Canadians pay less than $200. Americans pay $844 a year to cover insurance company overhead, while Canadians pay about $146. And just to see physicians, we pay about $465 a year on physician insurance-related costs, while Canadians spend about $87.
Oh, jeez.
We're paying four times more, and sometimes even more than that, than Canadians without even covering the soaring costs of health care and medication.
Okay, so and they're healthier, and they're all covered. I just want to remind everyone, not only do you see all these additional costs that we are incurring, but on top of that, there's universal coverage in Canada. There isn't universal coverage here. If you lose your health care, you can't afford the COBRA. And when you begin to factor all those other things in, it's kind of shocking. So here's the question I don't know if anyone has done. As you've been looking at the Hunter study, I sent you the Lancet study that was actually brought up,
right,
by the way, last night on the debate stage. We're taping this on Thursday morning. I was so excited. I'm like, yes, I sent that to Igor. But not only do we know that, but answer this question. Has anybody looked at what the Affordable Care Act did to rein in any of these costs? Because everybody, except for Bernie and Elizabeth, want to tweak the Affordable Care Act. They basically want to use that as the standard and just sort of do an expansion on that. When they implemented the ACA, I am kind of curious, did we see any adjustments at all in the costs of overhead, in the costs of, you know, CEO compensation, in the costs of administrative costs? I am just kind of curious because the numbers you're giving me said even if the numbers changed, they changed so infinitesimally that once again, we are spending too much money and it's not on health care, it is on paper care. So has anyone looked at whether there was a blip, there was a change, or would it be today without the Affordable Care Act, $1,000, you know, on administrative costs as opposed to $551. I'm kind of curious about whether there was any kind of impact which might speak well of the Affordable Care Act or basically say that the insurance companies and Big Pharma got exactly what they wanted and they're still making money hand over fist.
Right. So, I mean, the best part of Obamacare was the Medicaid expansion, which gave tens of millions of people health care. But as we've seen, insurance companies have only seen their profits continue to grow. Deductibles have continued to rise. And one of the reasons that the costs are so great for the insurance company, or the profits are so great for the insurance companies, is these companies are moving into the existing public Medicaid and Medicare programs. So more than half of the revenue that insurance companies make now come from Medicare and Medicaid recipients. So there are, for example, these private Medicare Advantage plans where 12% of premiums go towards covering overhead compared to just 2% in the traditional Medicaid program. Most people don't get traditional Medicaid programs anymore because most states have moved their recipients into these private managed care programs, which saves the state money but costs recipients twice as much in overhead costs because they get shifted to these programs that get managed by private insurers. So the ACA, while helping insure millions more people, has certainly increased profits for these insurance companies.
And, you know, what I think is so remarkable is that as you listen to the debates on the debate stage, and they sometimes – they don't really get into the weeds, which I wish they kind of would. And I think I would love to see, you know, Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar and Joe Biden address the fact that really the greatest expansion of health care was the expansion of Medicaid. It was a government program that really adds the most value to the ACA. It wasn't what they did with private insurance, that it was government that made the difference for so many people who were living on the edge. That's the irony. When you realize that people are the most satisfied with what? How many people go on Medicare and go, oh my God, I'm losing my private insurance. Damn it, I'm going on Medicare. Have you heard anyone ever say that?
Mike Bloomberg yesterday at the debate was talking about how people love their private insurance. Well, even the union insurance that you referred to in Nevada charges as much as $12,000 a year for a family of four.
It makes me smile, because in some ways we need to bring it back to how people actually live their lives. I tell you, when I turned 65, I had a party, and the party was Medicare. The party wasn't that I turned 65. It was like, take this burden from me. So as you begin to look at these things, one of the other things I'm sort of curious about, since obviously you look at this healthcare issue, is when you look at the rest of the world, the Medicare for All program that Bernie is talking about is more like the Canadian system. It is, however, not like the German system. It is, however, not like the French system. It is, however, not like the Swiss system. And also, even when you look at the Canadian system, Igor, Canada, when it went, you know, starting in 1962, when it suddenly embraced the idea of Medicare for All, they actually didn't do it with a switch. They didn't do it as a country as a whole. They did it province by province by province. And then the nation, after they experimented, figured out the kinks, then embraced it as a nation. Why is it that we're not allowed to tell people that part of the story, too? I think the cost part is very important. The savings part, the idea that we don't have to tie it to work, is very important. But even in the countries that we want to embrace, nobody did it the way Bernie has written it.
Right. Well, one of the things that the researchers in this study and also the study that was published in The Lancet have talked about is how Medicare for All would actually save money compared to these public option type plans that right. people like Biden and Buttigieg are pushing that would leave the insurance in place. So the Lancet study that you mentioned, right. which was by researchers at Yale, University of Florida, Maryland, they put an actual price tag on this. They saw that. They say that if we switch to a single-payer system like Medicare for All, the average American would save about $2,400 a year, and we would prevent about 68,000 unnecessary deaths a year. And these are really low estimates. Like, right. this only factors
Very
in the 30 million people who are uninsured right. in the current system. Allison Galvani, who's this Yale researcher who led this study, said the numbers would increase even more when you factor in the more than 40 million Americans who are underinsured. And there are many people who have insurance but simply can't afford it to use it because of high deductibles, co-pays, out-of-pocket expenses.
Right, right.
So not only would it prevent more deaths than the study estimate, and it would likely cost less, and the primary reason that healthcare is so much cheaper in other countries with these type of systems is the government can negotiate prices.
Right.
So this is one of the things that Bernie has talked about a lot, is
right.
the ability to reduce costs by negotiating with providers and pharmaceutical companies, similar to the way that Medicare already does. So this researcher, Galvani, says that the public alternative, which Buttigieg and other Democrats push, because it's apparently more politically palatable, it polls better, it would actually cost $175 billion more than the existing system while still leaving a lot of the problems in place and limiting the government's ability to negotiate costs.
Right.
So according to her estimate, the public option would actually cost $600 billion per year more than Medicare for All. So what these researchers are largely saying is that it may not be the best idea to move this along gradually, like some of the moderate candidates have said. And that's really been my takeaway from a lot of these studies, is that, yes, Medicare for All is very expensive, but the existing system is even more expensive. There was a study that was widely shared about a year ago, funded by the Koch brothers, that warned that Medicare for All would cost us $32 trillion over the next decade. But that's about $2 trillion less than the Department
system.
Of Health and Human Services estimates that Americans will pay for health care over that time. And then the upshot is that Medicare for All, who Medicare for All who want it, or the public option plan, or whatever you want to call it, would likely cost more than the Medicare for All system that these candidates
and people would still be left out. And people would still, I mean, so again, what you get with Medicare for All is that it is universal. The operative word, it is universal. It is not tied to a job. You don't have to worry about whether the insurance company will come in and cherry pick, because obviously that's part of the other problem with the public option, is that the insurance companies will say, okay, and we'll charge you less because you're healthy. If you're sick, go on the public option. If you're healthy, we'll charge you. I mean, this is, again, it just feeds into what insurance companies want. They don't want sick people. They don't want old people. They don't want people with pre-existing conditions. They just want to insure the healthy because it's healthy for their profits, not good for your health. So, I mean, in a bizarre way. And the other thing that I'm also curious about, as you've been looking at some of these studies, because you have more time to sort of maybe focus on these than I unfortunately should be, is that nobody is connected Medicare for All with two things that we are now seeing front and present. Everybody now is really afraid about climate change. So in the Wednesday's debate, what you heard is that a lot of people that are coming up in the caucus on Saturday really talk about climate change as being a real concern for them. Well, you know what climate change is also concerned for? It's concerned for your stability of employment. Because if you get wiped out by a fire, so does your business. If you get wiped out by a flood, so does your job. If the sea rises and there is no seacoast anymore, then guess what? Your restaurant is gone. Well, if your health care is tied to the job in the flood, or tied to the job with the fire, or tied to the job with the ocean rising, then guess what? You don't have health care. And the one thing you don't want to have to worry about is worry about the instability that was created by climate change, and then know that you can't protect your family when they're sick. I mean, nobody has made the connection that climate change is actually knocking on the door for Medicare for All, almost more than people saying, we care about our health. You better care about your health, because you don't know what job you're going to have, because climate change is going to change the nature of any kind of relationship with work.
Absolutely. And it's great that you mentioned that, because one of my next articles that I'm working on is about this study that was published earlier this week in Nature Energy that talks about how companies are ignoring the risk of climate change and how extreme weather is very likely to cause recessions like which we haven't seen before.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm going to take a page out of coronavirus. And that's the other thing that, you know, everyone says, well, it's not as bad as SARS. But, well, you know what, but it's spreading faster than SARS. And they haven't figured out how to contain it. And now it's impacting our economy because of the supply chain that's happening in China. And my daughter lives in Shanghai. And, you know, at least in China, it's very cheap to go to a doctor. The problem is, and it's not tied to work. And let me tell you what's happening right now. No factories are opening. And the reason they're not opening is that they're open, but nobody wants to go to work because they're afraid of getting sick. And so what you've got here is a really interesting situation. Imagine if you had to go to work in order to get your health addressed and you're middle of what? The coronavirus. I mean, again, if you really want to protect people from a national security perspective, and you're not just looking at climate change, and you're not looking at the fact that for so many people, healthcare is so unaffordable, take a look at the potential for a pandemic. Why the hell would you tie, you know, your healthcare to your job when people are suddenly, you know, cemented in place? Because there is this problem called a pandemic or an epidemic. That's another thing that sort of speaks to you want people to know they can go to a doctor and it isn't tied to whether they have a job. And I hope as you write these stories, climate change is one of them, but also what we're seeing in China is just another example of how our system will fail us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, God, Igor, it's just it's crazy. So I have only a few minutes left, and you've written a number of other stories, which I'm so grateful for, at Salon.com. And one of the other stories you wrote is near and dear to my heart. You were talking to me in Concord, New Hampshire. Well, that's really close to, Maine. And you wrote a piece, GOP Susan Collins faces tough re-election fight as support plummets following the vote to acquit Trump. What the hell does Susan Collins stand for anyway? If I was a Republican, I'd want to dump her. If I was a Democrat, I'd want to dump her. She has no place to go. I mean, I describe her as a mugwump. You know, she's sitting on the fence. She bends over this way. She bends over that way. And when you do that, guess what? There's nobody there to sort of vote for you or speak for you. I'm not surprised by her support plummeting. I'm trying to figure out who the hell supports her and why.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, Susan Collins' role during the age of Trump has been really interesting. But this is a hugely popular incumbent senator. She won her last election by, I want to say, like 40% of the vote. And now she's
underwater.
She now she's in a virtual tie with Sarah Gideon, who's the main Speaker of the House. She's one of four Democrats running in the primary, but she's the most likely to face off against her. There's a 43-42 split in this poll. After the last poll showed Collins leading by 16 points, that was pre-impeachment. So she's the most unpopular senator in the country now, according to this morning consult.
Couldn't happen to a nicer wimp. Oh, God. What are people saying as what will move? I mean, I understand this was after impeachment. What about, you know, after all the other things that are happening with the Department of Justice? What about what's happening with all the things with the pardons? I think with each passing hour, and you have Susan Collins saying, I'm sure he'll learn from the impeachment. And what has he learned? He's learned that he's now an unleashed tiger. All she did was let all the venom pour out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think even more so than the impeachment is her vote for Brett Kavanaugh, which really you saw a lot of backlash for her decision. In fact, the pollster that did this poll in Colby College in Maine talked about how she previously won with more than 60% of the women vote. It was one of her, it was the biggest demographic that supported her. And now, according to this poll, more than 60% of women oppose Collins, including 75% of women under 50. So that's going to be real tough sledding for her. And there's also a huge crowdfunding campaign that was launched after her Kavanaugh vote that has raised millions of dollars for her inevitable challenger. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a tough election.
Well, and as you point out, was it Shea that did the poll?
Dan Shea, yeah.
Dan Shea. So here's what you pointed out. And again, go to salon.com, everyone. It's just a fun article to read. Shea asserted that Collins could be a dying breed in Republican politics. Actually, she's dead. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, this does not exist. This breed does not exist. In fact, you know what this breed is trying to do? This dying breed in the Republican Party is trying to make the Democratic Party the moderate Republican Party that no longer exists. That's exactly what they're trying to do. I want people to understand that. Just watch MSNBC, and you will see all these never Trumpers basically trying to pick the nominee for the Democrats. So it'll be a party that is the moderate Republican Party that doesn't exist. But he writes, Senator Collins' brand has been one of moderation, fiscally conservative and socially liberal. She's pragmatic. She's secular, he said. That brand of moderate Republican doesn't fit well with the rest of the Republican world, the larger national Republican world that is being led by President Donald Trump and U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell. Here's the problem is that she's no longer even socially liberal. And I think you're absolutely right about the Brett Kavanaugh vote. The Brett Kavanaugh vote is proof that socially liberal was a fig leaf as well. She has walked away from so many things that are absolutely happening to her. And I just think that one of my producers just said, what about Susan Collins and her Hawaiian donors? What's that about? Do you know about that?
Yeah, so there was a LOC that was created in Hawaii just like days or weeks before the very first thing they did was donate a whole bunch of money to support Susan Collins. It doesn't appear that there's a business there, but it does appear that it was created simply for the purpose of moving a huge amount of money to support Susan Collins. And I would just note that the vast majority of Susan Collins' fundraising comes from out of state.
Well, it that doesn't surprise me. And I think at this point in time, I'm still trying to figure. I mean, the only reason why I think there is money coming in from Republicans coming in clandestinely under the radar is that Mitch McConnell needs to count votes. And this is not about what kind of a Republican she is. The only thing they care about is that she's an R. She's a reliable R when it comes to the impeachment vote. She's a reliable R when it comes to judges. She's a reliable R to ensure that Mitch McConnell becomes the majority leader. Mitch McConnell will sleep with a snake if it promises to vote for him. And I think part of the problem is that that's what Susan Collins is. She's not a dying breed. She's being propped up because she's a reliable Republican vote. And I think that's one of the reasons why now people are beginning to attack her. She isn't a conservative. She isn't secular. She isn't socially liberal. She is basically an arm of Mitch McConnell. And I think that's what's so frustrating for so many people. Igor, keep writing this stuff. I can't wait to read your other article, because I think to the large extent, we need to keep following all these other stories as we move forward. As you look at the article that you're about to write going into next week, the one about relating to climate, do you think we can make the connection for voters between climate change and things like healthcare? Or are they look like they are on two such separate planets that nobody will see the relationship?
Yeah, I think it is definitely difficult to make that link right now, just because so much of what we're talking about in terms of climate is going to happen in the future. whereas healthcare or the lack of healthcare accessibility is a huge problem right now.
Yeah, no, it's going to be fascinating to see whether voters actually understand that. Anyway, thank you so much for writing your stuff. It's great. And I just want people to know, just do the math when it comes to your current health plan and maybe what Medicare for All does. And if the math says you got more in your checkbook, hey, you know, you might as well go for something. You can still go to a doctor and don't worry about work and save some gibbons. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Bye.
All right, everyone, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We'll talk to you next week. You bet.